Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors.
Thanks all for joining us this morning. Delighted to announce our full year results. I'm CEO and co-founder of the group. I've been in tech services forever, certainly since the 90s. Built and sold a number of companies and had the idea for the Panoply back in 2016. My co-founder, Ollie Rigby here, came from a background in the city and then was had several roles, including a CFO of a listed company. And here we are today. We've been working together since December 16 on the Panoply, and been good fun. So let me take you through then the company itself. So we are in the digital transformation business. We're a digital transformation consultancy. When people talk about digital transformation, it's a very confusing term and it means a lot of things to a lot of people. Let me be super clear that for us, digital transformation does not mean working from home. And in recent commentary, there's been a lot of talk about, well, you know, working from home, that's digital transformation. It's not. Digital transformation is the wholesale change to how industries, sectors work, how they deliver service to their customers, how they deliver product to their customers. And the example we cite is not, obviously not our example, but the bigger one that everyone will know is iTunes to Spotify. So, and if you look at where we are in digital transformation, we're kind of in that iTunes to Spotify kind of stage at the moment. So iTunes came along, as you know, in the early 2000s, along with the iPod. And really all that did was change how we bought our music. We still bought music, but instead of going to the shop and buying a CD or getting a CD delivered, we would actually download the track to our device across the wires. But fundamentally, the industry didn't change particularly. It meant that artists continued to make their money from music. They toured to support the music sales. And then a few years later, a group of people in Stockholm created something called Spotify, and Spotify really was the disruptor. Because what Spotify did is it changed the way that people consume music. We moved to a model where we no longer had to own music. We moved to a model where we could stream whatever we wanted, wherever we were, at any time. And that was the disruptor, really. That was the change in the music industry. And now the music industry has been turned completely upside down. As you know, artists make money from touring and from merchandise, and no longer really make money from, with very few exceptions, no longer really make money from the music itself. That is the disruption in public sector. So today, the Panoply operates predominantly in public sector. Some 70-odd percent of our revenues on a pro forma basis come from UK public sector. And if you look at where we've been for the last decade, the austerity decade, we've done the iTunes bit. So what we've done is, you know, you can now tax your car online instead of going to the post office. You can renew your passport online. But really, underneath the surface, not much has actually changed. And the real opportunity for the group is over the next decade, we will move towards, in public sector certainly, we will move towards the Spotify era where we completely liberate our public services. We change the underlying tech stack that they use. We envision new kind of products and services or services that government should deliver to its citizens. You know, there should be no reason at all why we can't experiment with road pricing. There should be no reason at all why we can't come up with a benefit system that allows decisions to be made at the coalface around whether to give people money and how much to give people, rather than a sort of one-size-fits-all approach, which has been driven largely by the monolithic fixed systems that people have had to work with before. In recent weeks, we've seen the Chancellor introduce a number of measures to support the economy during COVID. Yeah, we know that there were several discussions around vouchers and whatever, but the reality is the technology was not in place for the government to actually execute on some of those ideas. We see the next decade as modernizing government to the point where such ideas can be put forward, experimented with, tried out very quickly, which will completely change the government-citizen relationship in the same way as in Spotify's case, the relationship between consumers and artists have completely and radically changed. So that's that's really what we're about and what excites us. In terms of the group and where we are today, today we are some 381 people, or as of the end of March, we're 381 people. We continue to deliver amazing work for, as we say, lots of public sector, but also some commercial organizations, Dow Jones, News UK, being a couple of examples. We operate in a high growth market. Digital transformation in the UK public sector is expected to reach £20 billion by 2025. So a huge growth market that we operate in. And today, you know, what we've done over the last 12 months is acquired various companies to build a jigsaw puzzle. And that jigsaw puzzle is approaching the stage where it's largely, from an end-to-end service perspective, largely complete. There are some gaps and there are some things that we have to add from a sub-vertical market perspective. But largely we can deliver, today we can deliver the end-to-end proposition from organizational design, service design, product management, full stack software, data analytics, AI, machine learning, robotic process automation, all the way through. We are one of very few companies in the mid-sector, if any, in the mid-size, that we would now regard ourselves as, who have that end-to-end capability. Yeah, you either have the very, very large organizations, and we'll come and talk about the competitive matrix in a while, but you either have the very large organizations who have an end-to-end proposition, but they're very large and monolithic, slow-moving, or you have smaller organizations that do a subsection rethink of digital transformation. And today we are one of the very few organizations that are mid-market and end-to-end, which is a great position that we find ourselves in.
So I just want to talk you through our first set of full year results. We came together as a group in December 2018 and effectively acquired four companies at that point. So looking at comparables is quite tricky because we only had 4 months worth of statutory results last year. So what we've tried to do is compare our results for the year against sort of pro forma numbers where appropriate. And stat and numbers where appropriate. But year on year, we've seen revenue growth of 43%. So from 22.1 million up to 31.5. You know, a lot of that driven by acquisitions in the period, acquisition of FutureGov and acquisition of Amio. We've also seen that translate into increased EBITDA. So EBITDA are up 62% from 2.1 million up to 3.4 million. We finished the year with a pretty strong backlog number, which we reported of £15 million coming into the beginning of the year. We've since updated the market around that and noted that we've won £13 million of new contracts in Q1. If you add our sort of recurring revenue to that number, you can see that backlog will have increased over the course of Q1, which shows the sort of strength of the business and where we're moving to, which is great. Cash at the end of the year remain again pretty strong at 4.6 million. Down year on year, mainly as a result of the fact that we used some of our cash, or 2.4 million plus exceptionals of another sort of £500,000 to acquire FutureGov and Amio, which is the reason for that decline. We subsequently updated the market that our cash has increased to 6.8 million at the end of the quarter, which shows sort of the strength of the cash generation over the course of the last couple of months. Pointing to our sort of first EPS number that has any real sort of meaning at 3.6p, adjusted profit after tax at 2.7 million. Worth noting that sort of our central costs are run at circa £2 million and we expect those to remain flat. So we're reporting an adjusted EBITDA number excluding those costs so that people can track that as we go forward, and again shows the underlying profitability of the group companies that we've brought in. Neil's already talked about public service revenue being close to 70%, so 64% on a stat basis in the year. On a pro forma basis, if you include Amio and FutureGov for the full year, it comes up to 70%, thereabouts. Just want to talk a little bit about repeat customers. So in the year, we billed 265 customers, up from 191 in the prior year. Of those 265 customers, 70% of those had been billed in the prior year. And I'll come on to talk a little bit about how we bridged to a revenue number from sort of recurring repeat and then new customers on the next slide. So come back to that. I think the next final point sort of really to pick up here, or a couple of points to pick up here, is collaborative revenue in the period was 8.9 million. So 28% of total revenue, and really sort of justification of the group coming together, and we're really seeing the businesses work really well together in collaborative projects that we've won during the year, including projects that no individual business would have been able to win by themselves. And finally, in terms of diversification in the period, we've seen that with the top 10 customers now accounting for 31% of revenue, down from 54% in the prior year. It's worth noting actually that the biggest of those was at 24% in the prior year, and that's dropped down to 10% in the current year. So just flicking on here to look at sort of the revenue breakdown, I think a lot of the time we got told, or a lot of people talked to us about the fact that we're a services business, no recurring revenue. And so what we thought we'd do is try and pull out some data that bridges how we made up our revenue in the course of the year. And I think that, yeah, hopefully gives confidence to people around, you know, our future numbers. So roughly 27%, 28% of our revenue last year was recurring. What we mean by that is sort of longer term contracts, typically lasting on average at the moment 31 months. And so we start the year with that. Repeat business during the course of last year was at circa 50% of revenue. So that, again, that ties back to that sort of 70% of customers, repeat customers coming back to use us the year after. 5.5 million or 17% of revenue came from new government contracts. I think it's just worth, you know, noting that, you know, new opportunities within government arise all the time. And because of the frameworks that we're on, you know, opportunities crop up. It's not the same as new business, I guess, in the commercial sector. So. You know, finding and creating those opportunities in new government spend is there for us. And then only sort of 1.8 or 5.7% was in new commercial revenue in the period, which takes us up to 31.5.
So an amazing year for us. As I say, really, last year was about building the organisation up to a certain scale. Today we find ourselves at 40 million run rate, puts us firmly in that mid-market space, which I think is all important. You know, we're seeing frameworks today that we're bidding at the moment where they've effectively said they want to see mid-market companies on there. They don't want to see the very large, but they also don't want to see the very small. And we see that as our opportunity. So it really is our opportunity now with the full stack there to position ourselves as an alternative provider of digital transformation services. Collaboration has become a way of life, and that really paves the way for something that we will talk about shortly, which is consolidation of brands. We acquired FutureGov and Amio, as we've already talked about, and really that FutureGov, Amio, those acquisitions really consolidated that position in the UK public sector or public services. And obviously we closed Arthurly post-period end. And what that did for us is really strengthen out, it's a very small acquisition, but it strengthened out our Microsoft capabilities, which was something that we were lacking before. So we're very keen to do that. In terms of our commercial vision, we decided to publish this on a formal basis in the RNS. Our vision is to be 100 million run rate revenue by March 2023 with 12 to 14 million EBITDA on a run rate basis as well. We will do that in a number of ways. So firstly, we will dial in organic growth, and that's what the consolidation of brands is really all about. And we'll talk about that in a while. We see a significant opportunity in the group that we've now created, and so we will dial in at that 10 to 15% organic growth over the next 3 years from where we are today. We see about 70% of our operating profit dropping through to positive cash flow. We intend to pay a dividend. We had intended to pay a dividend this year, but obviously COVID hit, and it wasn't felt to be a good time to be doing that in light of the uncertainty. We will continue to acquire, although I don't think you will see us acquire 11 companies in 20 months as we've done so far. I think it will be even more selective than we have been so far because we've got that end-to-end capability. You will see us add into some of the gaps that might still exist, or you will see us add into some of those subsectors. So when we look at higher education, health, local government, if there's something that fits and bolsters us in one of those subsectors, then you might see us acquiring those areas as well. But generally, you know, we intend to add about 35 million of revenue over the next 3 years, or just under 3 years now. we understand that liquidity is important, and you know, we want to be, we don't want to overextend ourselves. We intend to keep leverage below 1x EBITDA, so a very safe, what we regard as a safe limit for us to reach. We don't want to be going out there overextending ourselves, as I say. And I think on that basis, the goal is then to, as I say, reach 100 million run rate revenue and 12 to 14 million run rate EBITDA by March 23. And we feel very confident. You know, we've effectively grown to 40 million run rate in the last 3 years, and really since the IPO, in the 20 odd months since the IPO, really, we've grown to 40 million run rates. We see no reason at all why we can't successfully, profitably grow to 100 million by March 23. And that's certainly the plan that exists and has been transmitted, you know, communicated throughout the group, and lots of people bought into it.
So just a quick update around Q1, which we announced a week or so ago. Okay, the time flies by. So we had a record performance for the group in Q1 with really strong growth despite everything that was going on. So we saw 10% organic growth. Interestingly, I think we saw some projects come through that were specifically COVID-related, which was about 9% of revenue in the period. But we also saw a number of projects that were pushed back. So a 10% growth in revenue on a like-for-like basis, organic growth was strong, and very strong EBITDA performance at £1.7 million. In the quarter, which was up sort of 54% again on a like for like basis, or on a stat basis, those numbers are even higher. I've already talked about the significant new contract wins in the quarter at £13 million, you know, giving us good visibility, I guess, on the rest of the year. I think it's worth noting that, you know, Neil called it very, very early that we did not want to furlough any staff, and that our staff were key. Particularly in the government sector, and that could be seen as something that would be held against businesses going forward. I mean, so we took the position that we were keen not to furlough any staff, and actually, as it bore out, we actually didn't need to furlough any staff over the period anyway, because of very high utilization rates across the group. In terms of final point, again, I've touched on this already, a very strong balance sheet as at the end of the quarter, with cash increasing significantly by 2.2 million up to 6.8 million of cash, with net cash of 1.8 million. So that was very good, and I guess leaves us in a very strong position to pursue our acquisition strategy going forward.
In terms of our strategy, we use this quite a lot, and it's a long quote you can read in your own time, but just to focus on the highlighted bits, essentially, to paraphrase, really, what it's basically saying is there is an old adage that no one ever got fired for buying IBM. Well, that no longer holds true in public sector. And if you look at Michael Gove and Dominic Cummings and some of the things that they're saying, they fully recognize that innovation comes from a different kind of partner. And there is an opportunity for a new kind of organization to emerge that, as I say, offers that end-to-end capability, but does so in a very different way. I mean, you know, we see time and again public sector contracts that go to very large organizations failing on a frequent basis. Those sorts of things that, you know, people are no longer going to tolerate. There are some customers, I think, that will continue to go down that kind of very, what they perceive to be very safe road, and Michael Gove talks to this here. But there are increasing cohorts of chief digital officers, chief information officers, CTOs, CEOs, COOs, who are recognized that they really have to deliver that. I talked, I think, to public sector frameworks. There's one at the moment that we are bidding on. I mean, you know, no more to say than that. But one of the things that organization has said is that they don't want any of those monolithic companies to be on it. But they also don't want the very small either. They're very firmly looking for sort of mid-market companies to work with, those that are proven to have been able to deliver. And we certainly fit that with our numerous case studies across all the subsectors that we operate in. We see this statement as validation of everything that we've been saying for years now, that this is going to be the case. And we were delighted to see this quote back in on the 27th of June. In terms of the competitive landscape and where we see ourselves, we use the vertical axes of digital migrant and digital native, which is all about when you were founded. And, you know, in the lighter text there, you see some of what we see as the profound changes at the technology level that have occurred that change how consultancy works. You know, ranging from the Agile Manifesto all the way back in 2001 to hyperscale clouds being introduced from AWS and Microsoft Azure, to something called GitHub, which is a code repository where you can effectively grab pieces of code. 28 million open source contributors to that today. You know, this has fundamentally shifted how you deliver software. So much of what used to have to be written is now a commodity that you could rent in the hyperscale clouds. So much of what you'd have to write from scratch, you can just grab the code for from GitHub. And as a consequence of that, a well-functioning small end-to-end team comprising a service designer, a product manager, a user researcher, a UX person, a full-stack architect, full-stack software developers, you know, that small team can actually deliver way more than a very large team used to deliver way back when, particularly when they're working in that kind of very old-fashioned waterfall thing. And so what you've seen is you've seen the very large companies who were founded during, you know, way before all of these key innovations, have had to try and shift their organization towards towards operating in this kind of very changed landscape. And that we see as the opportunity. We see companies like Agilysys and Kainos, and actually to some extent BGSS as well. But we see those companies as companies that are making progress and heading in that direction. But we don't see anybody who exists in that mid-market that has that full service capability. At the moment, if you want full service, if you want end-to-end, truly want end-to-end, you know, world-class service design alongside world-class software development, alongside AI, machine learning and robotic process automation, at the moment, you really have no choice but to go to one of those, or historically, you've had no choice but to go to one of those very large organizations. And today we present ourselves as the group that you can come to. And in order to make that and facilitate that, we have a plan to effectively consolidate our brands and actually take a pincer movement around the client. So we have FutureGov as a full service brand. And you know, that looks at the world from the chief, the CEO, COO, organizational model downwards, because some clients look at digital transformation as an overall organizational strategy. And so they look at it from that perspective downwards. Other organizations look at it as that from their legacy technology upwards. So they want to move from their legacy technology, moving up into hyperscale cloud, liberating their data, embracing machine learning, looking at robotic process automation, looking at AI. And some of, you know, that particular customer base, CIO, CTO, to some extent, Chief Digital Officer in many cases, although they typically sit exactly between the two, they will, you know, they need a very different message. And so our two full service brands that we'll put more and more behind, and you will see some of our smaller brands effectively roll into these, or you will see our smaller brands roll into this over time. We have to do so very carefully. Those businesses are performing exceptionally well at the moment. Our robotic process automation and conversational AI businesses collectively grew at 600% last year. So, you know, we want to maintain that performance. So we have to tread very carefully. But you will see us begin to consolidate into these two brands with this very clear market message around public sector that shows our scale and our capability. And the idea is that those two brands, as I say, form a pincer movement around the client and meet in the middle, which is, we think, is an incredible opportunity for us moving forward. Some case studies, some examples, people say, what do you do? So a couple of examples of the kind of work that we do. Family Story, delivered by FutureGov, won, actually not in this, but last year won Public Sector IT Project of the Year. You know, what this did is it took a look from the ground up, from literally restarting how social work is delivered, how children's services is delivered across three boroughs in London. You know, if you look at how it works at the moment, typically social workers today spend 30, 40% of their time, if not more, either interacting with other agencies, communicating with other agencies, or just on administrative tasks. Then, you know, they're not, you know, and what they really want to do is being in front of vulnerable children, looking after families, helping those children in life. And so what we did here is we took an initial discovery phase, 60% spent on sort of recording and processing data. We looked at how they worked on a day-to-day basis. We redesigned the system end-to-end, and we effectively liberated something like 30% of their time. When we rolled this out, it was fascinating. We rolled this out, there were literally social workers with tears of joy because it was why they joined in the first place. They joined to help children, and this was the tool that they saw as liberating them to help those children. And this is something that we now plan to roll out into other local authorities going forward. So an incredible success story, one of those that you don't hear about in the press, an incredibly successful public sector IT project that went very, very well and is working today and delivering great value. The next case study is a deeply technical one, and I apologize to some extent for that, but you know, we are at the one side we're world class on service design, on the other side we're world class in software development. And this is Hello Nina. This is for a global accountancy firm that wanted to effectively streamline the audit process. And so we used Microsoft Azure's cognitive services, created a natural language conversational application. You know, I talked earlier about the stuff that's available in the hyperscale clouds now that are services that you can rent. 15 years ago, it would have been almost unheard of that you could buy and rent cognitive services. But you can do that now. And so as a consequence of that, this global firm has been able to start to offer audit services to smaller organizations by keeping their costs of audit down and yet still relying upon the automation that's available here. So really a radical change in how that service is delivered. And so these are just two examples of how we work. So moving on to summary and outlook, we're in a huge and growing total addressable market, 20 billion by 2025. The market trends are very much in our favor. That move towards mid-market is very much in our favor. We have what we need today to really drive that organic growth. We will continue to add acquisitions as we see the gaps and look to fill those gaps. We plan to do so with ever-improving margins and ensuring a strong cash conversion. I think Ollie talked to, I think in our result, we said 91% cash conversion ratio. But we want to retain that entrepreneurialism. We want to see startups within the group continue to come about. We want the innovation to come from the edges. You know, if you look at the robotic process automation business, it was an idea from one of our existing teams. We backed them, and that, as we say, that business could, together with the conversation AI business, has grown 600% last year. And I think we're incredibly well positioned now to deliver on that commercial vision of reaching 100 million run rate revenue, 12 to 14 million EBITDA by March 2023. And I think on that note, we will go to questions.
And Gareth Evans from Progressive has a question. Go ahead and ask your question.
Quick question, just in terms of culture and the way that you manage the group, it's quite an interesting sort of dynamic. Clearly, you've got ambitions to expand very rapidly. And so the scale of the group will increase in terms of, you know, the scope of the projects that you're working on, and clearly the number of employees and contractors that you're working with across the group. How do you juggle that to try and make sure that you maintain that entrepreneurial spirit? Just some practical examples of what you do day to day to keep the organization sort of flexible and agile, which is clearly key for what you're doing, even as you expand and grow, and that the risk is you become more like those sort of monolithic competitors that you've talked about.
So thanks, Gareth. I think the first thing is we very much see ourselves operating a model of servant leadership. So we in the centre are here to serve our the people that work at the coalface, that work with clients. We see innovation and support the innovation and the ideas that come from them. We foster a culture of collaboration. You know, we're very open to new ideas, and they do very much see us not as this kind of typical sort of top-down autocratic kind of management style, but very much a as I say, servant leadership model. So I think that helps the entrepreneurialism. We're there. We constantly remind that we're there to support them. The other thing that holds and binds the group together, though, is this deep sense of purpose. And I think, you know, if you cut through the middle of everyone, there is a sense of public service that runs deeply through everyone. And those values, those deeply held values, kind of overcome so many things that would traditionally be very difficult in a buy and build situation. You know, as I've seen myself in the past, you know, where those buy and builds have been largely financially driven, you know, they've been about arbitrage, valuation arbitrage, making a few people very wealthy or whatever it might be. You know, those have rapidly fallen apart, and we've seen that happen time and again. You know, the people who join our group and the companies that now come into our group really want to make a difference to the public sector in particular. And, you know, that's a deeply held view that they want to create change. They've typically been practitioners within the sector. I mean, so many of our people have worked in the sector that we now sell into. They've seen the challenges and they've come out and wanted to make a positive change. And that cuts all the way through so many of our people now. So I think that's part of the answer as well.
Yeah. Oh, no, that makes perfect sense. Thank you. And it sort of almost answers my next question as well, which is in terms of the competitive landscape, the slide that you gave in terms of the year of founding of those businesses, some of the larger, you know, more full service organizations are relatively old, as you pointed out. In terms of your M&A strategy, do you have a strong view about the age or the year of founding of your target companies that you look to acquire, or are you sort of fairly open on that?
I think what we want to see is digital native companies for whom this method of working, because it's actually a much, much, much faster pace because of the nature of the workflows and how they work. It's way quicker. And so, you know, it's not for everyone, this way of working. And so we're looking for those kind of companies that are those digital natives that understand how to work and that it's embedded within them already.
And we'll go to Paul Richards at Dowgate.
A couple of questions from me. First, when you deliver a project like Family Story to three boroughs, and then you go to other local authorities, how happy are they to adopt the same approach? Do you have to resell from scratch, or are they happy to take the learnings from where it's been implemented before? And the second question is if you could provide a bit more colour on the collaborative work that you're doing across the panoply. And in particular, when you land larger contracts, do you think that these will be stickier relationships with more of a focus on recurring revenues? Thank you.
So the first one, in terms of Family Story itself, actually, local authorities tend to be quite collaborative. They're happy to work together. They're happy to share learnings. There are many forums that they have where they do share that. It's not the same as the commercial sector, obviously. Particularly on Family Story, there is, you know, we haven't yet made a decision as to whether to more formally productize that or not. So at the moment, the way that it's rolling out is the teams that have the experience. You know, if you look at FutureGov and the amount of work that they've done on children's social services up and down the country, they are very much seen as sort of experts in that sector, and we're able to leverage that learning everywhere. The IP itself, there's no desire, I don't think, in councils to get into the complexity of owning IP, so they are very happy to generally share that. So that's that.
Just one more on that. I think that there was one contract that we worked on in the year where we pulled together 10 different local councils who all gave us 20 grand each in order to look at, you know, how do you really shake up local government and present back some ideas to them. So that was a really interesting project that we're just in the process of sort of putting back to those guys and focusing on some key areas which really could drive significant change into local government.
Yeah, and the other one was about collaborative. So an example would be NHSX. NHSX was set up to explore the use of AI within the NHS. Four of our companies came together to bid that. The reality is not one of them on their own could have bid it, because they didn't individually have the breadth of capability required. We won that back in January, I think it was. We won the contract to run the NHSX AI lab. And you know, as I say, four of our companies were involved in that. And that's, I guess that's what we see moving forwards, is more and more of that kind of collaborative win taking place. And there are many examples. Camden was another recent example, where I think three of our companies worked together, and that there are more and more of that. That's why I think we've gone from, you know, where we were a year or more ago to, at the end of the year, end of March, 28% of our revenue now is collaborative. It's because it's just become a way of life in the group now.
And the type of contracts that you would work on collaboratively would tend to be larger, multi-year contracts. Would that be fair to say?
I don't necessarily think they're always multi-year. I think, you know, in the new world, and this is part of the challenge that I think the monolithic companies have, is they want to work in multi-year engagements, 5-year, 10-year, you know, in the case of Capita, for example, 10-year type deals. And clients, customers, public sector customers are increasingly adverse to signing up to those, for any number of reasons. The world is changing too quick to sign up to 10-year things in many cases. But what they do tend to do is sign into frameworks that can often last 1 or 2 years. And then you work on a statement of work by statement of work basis, but with a committed spend. But then you have this huge amount of repeat business. 70% of customers billed last year in the year to 31st of March were billed in the previous financial year. And as Ollie showed on that revenue bridge slide, you know, almost half of the revenue was repeat revenue. So it's a different kind of relationship moving forward. And then of course, we have the recurring revenues. We see our robotic process automation business beginning to sign managed service type contracts at the moment. So we're seeing some of that recurring occur there as well, which is an exciting new development.
I think just to add a couple of points to that, Paul, the whole positioning of Foundry 4 and FutureGov as our two main brands is around this, is about taking the full stack capability of the group out to market for the first time. So I think, you know, to date, the businesses have collaborated together where the opportunity sort of comes about, or you know, it's been not the exception rather than the rule, but it hasn't been the rule. And I think that the plan is to make it more of the rule going forward. I think the other opportunity for us is probably in terms of we've got a business in Eastern Europe, which allows us to scale other parts of our group collaboratively, I guess, by building teams in that region and helping us to drive margin over time. So Human Plus, again, the RPA business that that Neil mentioned, was set up effectively as a joint venture between Human Plus and the business in Bulgaria, where we've got the majority of our devs are based out there. And as a result, that business is generating gross margins at circa 50%. So, I think that's another huge opportunity for growth for the group and collaboration for the group, and using the model out in Bulgaria to really provide the engine room for other group companies as we go forward.
Hayley Palmer at FinCap asks, do the current market pressures present any discount acquisition opportunities?
It's an interesting question, because we buy great companies. We're in the professional services business, and so buying a failing or struggling company is not necessarily what you'd want to do. We do see some opportunities for, you know, we saw it with Arthurly. We saw a small subscale company, a little worried about the future based upon what was going on around and looking for a safe harbor, really, that gave us great capabilities, and you saw that we paid very little in reality for that. We'll see very quick return on investment on that, but we've probably already seen it based upon a couple of new things that have happened. So, you know, there is a bit of that, I think, that we might see. But generally, I think we're looking for really great companies that have really great reputations that are trading well through this period. Now, whether we see any in commercial sector, I don't know yet. We shall see. But at the moment, we're looking, as I say, looking for great companies.
We have reached the end of the questions now. So, Neil, do you have any closing remarks?
No, just I guess thank you all for joining us and taking the time. It's been a phenomenal year for us again. We're delighted with the performance. As I say, I think we've set ourselves up now to deliver on that commercial vision of 100 million by March 23, run rate by March 23. We feel in a really strong place to go off and do that now. And the consolidation of brands that we're undertaking now, the next stage of growth for the group, I think is very exciting, and that the market's continues to come right towards us.
PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.